pull up a chair. I want you to imagine a sound first. Not a whine, not a scream. A low thundering growl that you feel in your breastbone before your ears ever catch up. That's 18 cylinders in two staggered rows, 2,800 cubic inches of Pratt & Whitney iron spinning a four-bladed paddle prop as tall as a man. 1943, a muddy fighter strip in England, and the biggest single-engine fighter anybody had ever strapped a human being into is rolling out into the fog. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar. Today we're going to talk about an airplane that everybody underestimated, including the men who first flew her. The Republic P-47 Thunderbolt, though nobody who loved her ever called her that. They called her the Jug. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and I'll tell you what. If there was ever an airplane that earned a coin of its own, it was this one. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So let's set the scene properly. Back when Avigaz was cheap and airspace was free, fighter design was a religious argument. And the church had two congregations, one side worshipped light and nimble, keep it small, keep it slim, put a liquid-cooled inline engine up front and dance, the Spitfire crowd, the Messerschmitt crowd. Angels on the head of a pin, and then there was a Russian immigrant named Alexander Kartveli, working for Republic Aviation out on Long Island. And Kartveli looked at that whole argument and essentially said, no, we are going to do the opposite of all of it. Here's where it gets interesting.
The heart of the whole thing wasn't even the engine, not exactly. It was a turbo supercharger. Now stay with me, because this is the part most folks skip, and it's the part that made the airplane what she was. Up high in the thin air where the bombers flew, a normal engine chokes. There just isn't enough air to make power. The Germans dealt with it one way, the British another. Kartveli dealt with it by bolting a General Electric turbo supercharger into the belly of the airplane, way back behind the pilot, and running a great long snake of ductwork from the engine all the way aft and back again. Exhaust gas that would have just blown out the pipes and been wasted, that spun a turbine wheel back near the tail. That turbine crammed thick, dense air back up to the engine, and the result was that when a Thunderbolt climbed up to 30,000 feet, she didn't get weak. She got mean, she made her best power exactly where the fighting was. But that plumbing had a cost. All that ducting, the turbo, the intercoolers, the tanks, you had to build the fuselage around it. You couldn't make her small. And so she came out heavy. When they wheeled out the first Thunderbolt, she weighed in the neighborhood of 6-7 tons empty, and a fully loaded Jug could go 8 tons. 8 tons for a single-seat fighter. The pursuit pilots of that era were used to airplanes half that weight. You should have heard what they said about her. They called her the repulsive scatterbolt. They said she'd never turn, never climb, never dogfight. One pilot famously said that if you got in trouble in a Thunderbolt, you could always undo your straps and run around the cockpit to hide, because there was that much airplane around you. The 7-ton milk jug, that's actually where the name Jug comes from. At least that's one story. Some say it's short for juggernaut. I've heard old-timers swear by both. I'll let you pick. Now let me put you in that cockpit. Because the flying reports, the honest ones, they tell a more interesting story than the jokes did.
You climb up on the wing. It's a long way up. You settle down into a cockpit that's roomy, genuinely roomy, wide and comfortable. More like sitting in a good truck than perching in a fighter. You fire up that double wasp and the whole airframe shudders and settles into that deep growl. And when you push the throttle up and that paddle prop bites, she does not leap off the ground. She gathers herself, she needs runway. She's a big girl and she wants room to get going. But once she's up, and once she's up high, something changes in a dive. There was nothing in the sky that could stay with her. That 8 tons that everybody laughed about on the ground turned into raw, unstoppable momentum going downhill. German pilots learned this the hard way. A Focke-Wulf or 109 could outturn a Thunderbolt at low altitude all day long. But the Jug pilot had a card to play, nose over firewall it, and go downhill. And that Messerschmitt trying to follow would find its controls going stiff as concrete as it approached compressibility, while the Thunderbolt just kept accelerating, screaming down through the weather like a runaway freight train, and gone. Boom and zoom, they called it. Come down out of the sun, hit hard, and use all that beautiful momentum to climb right back up where you started. You don't dogfight a lighter airplane on its terms. You fight on yours. And then there was the punch. 850 caliber Browning machine guns, 4 in each wing. Let that sink in. When a Thunderbolt pilot squeezed the trigger, he was throwing a wall of lead better than 3,000 rounds a minute, and he could hold that fire for a good while because those big wings had room for a lot of ammunition.
pilots said a 2-second burst from a jug could saw a locomotive in half. And before long, that's exactly what they had them doing. Now here's the turn in the story, and it's the part I love most.
The Thunderbolt was built to be a high-altitude bomber escort. That's her job. Fly up in the cold and the thin air and protect the heavy bombers. And she did that, but as the war ground on and the long-range Mustangs took over more of the high escort work, somebody looked at this enormous overbuilt bomb-proof airplane and had an idea, sent her down low. And it turned out that everything that made the jug a compromise up high made her a monster down on the deck. That air-cooled radial engine, a liquid-cooled engine, one rifle round through the coolant and you're a glider in about 5 minutes. But that big Pratt and Whitney radial, you could shoot cylinders clean off of it and it would keep hammering away, dragging that pilot home on the ones that were left. Let me tell you about a man named Robert S. Johnson. Bob Johnson was one of the great Thunderbolt aces, and early in his combat career, he got jumped, got into a fight he couldn't win, and a German pilot flying a Focke-Wulf 190 worked him over thoroughly. Johnson's airplane took, by some counts, more than 20 cannon shells and better than 200 bullets. His canopy was shattered, his hydraulics were shot away. Oil coated the windscreen so he could barely see. He was wounded. The airplane was a flying wreck. And then the story goes, that German pilot pulled up alongside him, looked him over. This shot-to-pieces American in a shot-to-pieces airplane, and the German fired the rest of his ammunition into the Thunderbolt at close range. And when his guns ran dry, he flew up close, looked across at Johnson, shook his head, saluted, and peeled away home. Because there was nothing more he could do. The jug would not go down. Bob Johnson flew that airplane back across the channel and landed it in England, full of holes. And the ground crew counted the damage and could not believe a man was standing there in front of them. That airplane, that ugly, heavy, over-engineered milk jug that everybody laughed at, had done the one thing a fighting airplane is really for. It brought its pilot home. That story got around, and every Thunderbolt pilot took heart from it. Down on the deck in the ground attack role. That's where the jug wrote her real legacy. Late in the war over France and Germany, the Thunderbolts came down into the mud and the flak and went to work. They carried bombs. They carried rockets under those big wings, and they carried those 850s, and they hunted trains, trucks, tanks, bridges, supply columns. A German soldier trying to move men and material in daylight in the last year of that war lived in genuine terror of the Jabos. That's what the Germans called them, coming down out of the overcast, with that unmistakable growl, pull up a chair with any old ground pounder from that war. And he'll tell you the sound of a Thunderbolt coming in low was the sound of a very bad day. And the airplane could take the punishment that ground attack dishes out. Down low, everybody shoots at you. Every rifle, every machine gun, every quad flak cannon, and the jug flew home from things that would have swatted a lighter airplane out of the sky like a fly. Pilots came back with cylinders shot away, with feet of wing missing, with the fabric of their tail shot to ribbons, with tree branches and telephone wire wrapped around the airframe from flying too low, and that Pratt and Whitney just kept growling. By the end of the war, Republic had built more than 15,000 of them. More than any other American fighter in history. They served everywhere. Europe, the Pacific, the Mediterranean, other air forces flew them. The Free French, the British in Burma, the Soviets, the Brazilians, the Mexicans. That last one gets forgotten. Mexico sent a fighter squadron to the Pacific flying Thunderbolts. The Aztec Eagles. Now let me tell you what it feels like to stand next to one today, because a handful of them still fly, and everyone is a treasure.
You walk up to a P-47 at a fly-in, and the first thing that hits you is the sheer size. You expect a fighter to be delicate. This thing is architecture. That cowling is enormous, a great round drum of a thing, and you understand instantly that there's a very serious engine behind it. The prop blades are wide as canoe paddles. And when the crew fires her up, when that double wasp catches and coughs blue smoke and settles into that idol, you feel it in the grass under your boots. There are folks out there right now doing the Lord's work, keeping these birds flying. Warbird outfits and museums who've spent years and fortunes bringing Thunderbolts back from wrecks and gate guards and jungle hulks. A restored airworthy jug is one of the rarest sights in the warbird world, rarer than a Mustang, rarer than a Corsair. When one taxis by, the whole ramp goes quiet and everybody just watches, and I think there's a lesson in this airplane that goes past the history. Everybody underestimated the Thunderbolt because they judged her by the fashion of the day. She was too big, too heavy, too ugly. She didn't fit the picture in everybody's head of what a fighter was supposed to be, and she went out and outbuilt, outlasted, and outfought most of the airplanes that looked prettier on paper. Because she was built honestly around a hard engineering problem, by a man who didn't care what the airplane was supposed to look like, he cared what it needed to do. There's something in that for all of us who love this stuff. Don't judge an airplane, or a pilot, or much of anything,
by whether it fits the fashionable picture. Judge it by whether it brings you home. The details of Bob Johnson's fight and the broader history of the airplane are drawn from his own wartime accounts and from the records kept by the museums and warbird organizations that still fly and preserve these machines, and I'm grateful to every one of them. You can find us at RadioHangar.com. Next time you hear a big radial coming and you feel it before you hear it, think of the jug and think of every man she carried home full of holes.
This is Tail Dragger. Keep your speed up in the descent, and I'll see you next time.